This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network today. With us is Pam Gardeau. She's a librarian and the organizer of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. And with us also is Jonathan Slatt. He is the author of Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. And it's a book that will be featured during the book festival. Have you attended the Chippewa Valley Book Festival? What did you like about the experience? Or maybe you've read Owls of the Eastern Ice. What questions do you have about fish owls? Give us a call. We want you to be part of the conversation. 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Good to be
Thanks,
here.
Jill. It's a pleasure.
You bet. Well, Pam, let's start with you, since that's kind of the main reason why we're talking to John today. Tell us about the book festival.
Well, the Chippewa Valley Book Festival is an organization totally run by volunteers, which is really kind of special. And this is our 24th year of bringing wonderful award-winning authors like John to talk about their books and share the joy of reading and writing.
That's amazing. It's been going on for so long. What did you do during the pandemic?
Well, we did have some virtual events during the pandemic. And really, that's what led us to making more and more of our events virtual as well as in person.
That was my next question. So how is that going to work with the guests that you have this year?
Well, when people register for the events on our website, cvbookfest.org, they will have the option of either saying they want to attend events in person, and so they'll register in person, or they can register for a virtual link and watch it live streamed. We'll even be able to have links so that people can watch events after the fact if they've been away and couldn't make the day of the event.
That's wonderful. Now, is there a cost to attending?
Absolutely not. The only thing that there was a cost for is we have a meal event that is sold out now, but everything else is free of charge.
Okay, and that takes place when?
It will be from the 11th through the 16th. We will have events, and most of them will be held at the Ellie Phillips Memorial Library in Eau Claire, although we will have one event at Stout University.
Okay, great. And let's get over to you, John. So you have a really interesting book, and I actually listened to it, and you read the whole thing. That must have been an experience on its own.
It was. I honestly didn't enjoy it. It was eight hours a day of speaking as perfectly as possible. After the first day, it's like, I don't want to go back.
Yeah, recording a book is not easy. I definitely had a lot of tribute to you there, because it's a long book, too. There's a lot of information in there. Was it kind of fun going back over it after, you know, you've put all the work in writing it?
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that it taught me as a writer is is to write shorter sentences, because it was extremely difficult to get through some of the sentences in one breath.
There's a difference between writing for audio or writing for reading. That's what we have to do here with our scripts too, is read them out loud and you'll know for sure if it works. But anyway, let's talk about fish owls. I had never heard of fish owls before, and I have a feeling that some of our audience hasn't either. Tell us a little bit about them.
Sure. These are really interesting birds. I mean, it's the largest owl species in the world. And so they weigh up to about 11 pounds. And that might not sound like a lot, but for a bird, it is. And if you compare it to probably the largest owl in Wisconsin, the great horned owl, these weigh up to three times what a great horned owl weighs. So they're not three times larger, but they weigh three times more. Mm-hmm. So they're about the size of a fire hydrant. They've got these big floppy ear tufts, and they're just. I think I described them as disheveled masses of wood chip brown.
Yes, I love that description. But it's fitting. That's what they look like.
Yeah, and they live in Northeast Asia, mostly on the Russian mainland. There's a few hundred of these birds in Japan. There's almost certainly some in China, possibly North Korea. So about 500 to 850 pairs total. So they're endangered. And they're fish eaters, as you might expect. They're aquatic prey specialists. They eat salmon and frogs and lamprey and just about anything they can get at in a river.
Mm-hmm. And they have a very interesting call. And we dug up one, and I don't know if you actually recorded this, but someone probably in your group did. So let's hear that call. Very, very low. Yeah, thank you, Trina. Very unusual. I thought it sounded kind of like someone blowing into a bottle. You know, that real ooh. So is it hard to hear in the wild?
It is. And I want to, so there was a four-note call there, if you could make that out. And I want to make it clear, that's not one bird. That's two birds vocalizing together.
Yeah,
and
crazy.
It's not the first bird doing the first two notes and the second bird doing the next two. It's synchronized. It's a call response, which is really it's uncommon among birds.
Mm-hmm.
And it is difficult to hear. The frequency is so low that I've recorded it with sort of a standard parabola, and it's just the sound wave is too wide to really capture that. So even if a bird is really close, it sounds always, as you said, sort of tinny and far away.
Yeah. I mean, looking for little clips that we could use, I'm like, oh my gosh, this sounds like forever. Can we get these calls? Trina did a wonderful job of making it sound really good. So kudos for her. Pam, let's get back to you really quick. Why did this book interest your committee?
Well, first of all, it's wonderfully written. It's part travelogue, part adventure, part survival story, both for the humans trying to save the owls and the owls trying to be saved. And so it has won, I don't know if you noticed, but it's won a lot of awards, and it's just, it was my favorite nonfiction read of the year.
Ah, mm-hmm. Well, I can see that, because it was definitely not what I expected, John. I expected it to be a lot more information-based. Like when I saw it, I'm like, why is this so big? So why did you decide that part of it, like Pam had just said, was important to get into this book?
I will say that right when the book came out, this book came out in August of 2020. So, the fact that we're still talking about it more than 3 years later is pretty remarkable. But one of the first reviews was by, was in The Guardian, it was by Helen MacDonald. She wrote H is for Hawk. And so here's an author. She wrote a book about a bird and she convinced a lot of non-bird people to read her book. And so the review was essentially an endorsement of mine. She's like, look, you might not think you're interested in birds. But it's okay. Give it a shot. And so that was my first indication that maybe this book would do well, that it would cross genres. It wouldn't just be the bird nerds and the russophiles who would be attracted to the text.
Yeah, and I obviously that's exactly what happened, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And mm-hmm. I think you're right. It's the combination. It's not just, and it's funny because the bird people complain that there isn't enough about birds. Say, well, why don't we know more about these people? So I think it's a good balance that you're putting in some information, but enough to leave people frustrated.
Yeah, I've always felt that way too. If you get complaints on both ends, then you're probably okay.
Right,
so that's really good. So tell us a little bit about this adventure of yours. Now, first of all, you've been traveling to Russia for a long, long time, and you encountered a fish owl when you were fairly young. Tell us about that.
Yeah, right. So I'm a U.S. citizen. My dad was a U.S. diplomat. So I grew up living in different countries around the world. He was stationed at various embassies. And so the first time I was in Russia, I think I was 16. So I was pretty young. And ended up joining the Peace Corps. Peace Corps is no longer in Russia, but they were there for most of the 1990s. And happened to see a fish owl on the edge of the village. And I'd known about them for a little while. I'd spent a few weeks in Vladivostok, in the Russian Far East on the Sea of Japan. I spent a few weeks there and with a host family, and they had gifted me this book about birds of the Soviet Far East. And there were these grainy pictures of a fish owl in there. And I was already a bird watcher at that point. And, Rybny filin, like direct translation, fish owl. I'm like, what is that? What is an owl that eats fish? I'd never heard of it. It was just this romantic sounding creature. And the images in this book, you know, they were grainy, they were black and white. It's this one owl is sitting in a hole in a tree with a fish dangling out of the hole. Another one's sort of got this frog in its mouth. So they became this sort of mythical creature for me. And I never thought I'd actually see one. And then when I was in the Peace Corps, just on the edge of a village, there it was, just vocalizing. And, and I didn't, the bird was so, as I said, mythical for me that I couldn't believe it, that it was really a fish owl. And thankfully I had a camera and I took photos. And then, in sort of the clear light of time, I was able to look at the photos and then compare them to a field guide and say, yes, it's a fish owl.
Was it kind of like love at first sight for you?
Yeah, and part of it was, I adore being in the forest. I love being
outside.
Well,
you must, John, because you put up with a lot to study and research these birds.
But I'm extremely clumsy. I fall over. I knock into things. And so seeing this owl, like the first thing I saw this owl do was like run into stuff flying away. So I was like, oh, it's like
your
me.
Your spirit animal.
So I was, yeah, instantly drawn to it. Yeah.
I love that. Now, Pam, did you know about fish owls before you read the book?
I had no idea. None.
And so are you a big fan now?
Well, I am. I'm a fan of people that can write in an engaging way about subjects. And so I'm a big fan of John's.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. And so for anybody out there, I think most of our audience probably would be very interested in reading this book. Again, it's Owls of the Eastern Ice, just because they are interested in birds. But even if you're not interested in birds, you will be interested in the people of the area. Tell us a little bit about them, John.
I think there's a wild places attract strange people. And if you look at the Upper Peninsula of Michigan or Alaska.
Where I'm from.
Be
careful. But you're right.
People who are either born there or people who go to those places, there's a certain mentality of independence and, maybe just some general strangeness. And so when we're in the woods, this part of Russia is extremely extremely low human population density, and you don't often run into people. But the people you run into are they always have great stories. I mean, there's this one guy, probably my favorite. There's a man named Anatoly, and we kind of encountered him randomly in the forest, and he was squatting in a World War II era hydroelectric station that's now, catastrophically declined and is no longer functional. But he'd been living there for about a decade by himself. And it took over the course of years, finally kind of got the story that that he fled there from Vladivostok, from the city. There was some bad business deal. I mean, the early 1990s was not a great time to be in Russia. There's a lot of money being made, but there were also a lot of dangerous things happening. And he kind of fled to the forest and was there by himself. And really ill-adapted to live in the forest. That was one thing that struck me. So he made some skis. He needed to have skis to get around. And he made skis out of 2x4s, right? I mean, that's not a functional ski.
No. He sounds like quite the character. And we'll hear a little bit more about that in just a bit. We're talking with Jonathan Slatt, author of the book Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl. And Pam Gardo, she's an organizer of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival, and that's where you can hear John speak on Friday. What questions do you have for them? Lines are wide open. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@WPR.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Claren Neipert is our producer today, and Trina LaSousa is our technical director. Make sure you stay around with us, because at 11:45, we're going to talk about owls in our neck of the woods in the Midwest. So we'll get more information about that. Right now, we are looking to Russia to find out about owls, the fish owl. And let's talk a little bit more about your research study, Jonathan. What was your plan, and what exactly did you have to do?
Right. And I think it's important to note that this was the story that went into the book was my PhD research at the University of Minnesota, where you know, this was an endangered species. It was known to be endangered, but it was so it's such a cryptic, shy bird, and they tend to if they sense a human's coming close at 100-150 yards, they'll fly off. So even seeing one is hard. And you know, despite the endangered status, there was no management plan for these birds. You've got, you know, in the 1990s, all these new roads being built. There's more logging, there's more fishing. You know, how these industries are impacting fish owls was not known. And that was the basis of the project, to team up with Russian ornithologists, combine our different skill sets into developing a conservation plan that we could then share with local industries. So we're not interested in preservation of a landscape or the species. We're more interested in conservation. So finding a way that local livelihood needs can still be met. People can still log, people can still fish, but then there's enough land and space left for fish owls and other wildlife as well.
And you had to start from scratch, basically, because there really wasn't anything that was there for you, was there?
Yeah, that's true. So there had been some research done in Japan with fish owls, where I mentioned there's about 200 there. So this has been an extremely active conservation program since the early 1980s. But it's been done sort of in secret because they're so endangered there. They don't, you know, they don't want the public to know too much. And so I wrote to folks in Japan, fish owl biologists, being like, hey, how do you catch a fish owl? And, you know, I did not get responses.
Understandable. I mean, because you could be lying and you might be just want to.
Exactly. I was an unknown, you know.
Sure.
25-year-old from the U.S.
Now I bet you'd get a better response.
Yeah, I'm having a Japanese fish owl biologist spending the night on my couch in about a week. So.
Perfect. There you go. All right. Well, let's just jump back to the book festival real quick. Pam, can you tell us some of the other books that are going to be there and their authors?
Sure. I just want to clarify that I am only one of many volunteer organizers for the festival, but I am on the authors and events committee, so we're the author selection committee. But one of the authors that I'm really excited about is Another Kind of Nature Survival by Carol Dunbar. And she and her family actually do live in the North Woods of Wisconsin off the grid. And she's written a wonderful fiction novel about a family that survives off the grid and the trials and the survival and the brutality of winter and the beauty and wonder of nature. So this is both a survival story and a nature story, and you'll never look at trees the same way after you read her book. But she will be on Saturday. Saturday we'll have five different authors presenting, and so that's a great day to come to the festival.
And what's the name of the book? Because we all want to know.
The Net Beneath Us.
Okay, The Net Beneath Us. Gotcha. And what else?
And another book that has been on bestseller lists for months and months and months is Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. And this is one of those big-hearted, wonderful books about, you know, different narrators. There's several points of view. They're all looking for family and connection. And one of the characters whose point of view is told is an octopus. And so we all know how interested people are in octopus species. But this has a cantankerous, snarky octopus as part of the one of the characters.
I would think octopi would be kind of that way. They just
yeah.
seem to be.
we have fantasy novels. Nevo is a fabulous fantasy author, and so she will be talking about her books and the craft of writing. We have a nature book by Doug Tallamy, who's interested in the survival of insects, so that our world can survive because we depend on insects for food, and so he has written a wonderful book called Nature's Best Hope, which is our community read book this year as well.
We actually had Doug on with us, and we talked about that book, and I was happy to see your list that we've actually covered a couple of the books that are on this. So great selections there. Kudos to you. Is there any other ones that you think our audience would be more interested in nature-wise?
Well, we have a biologist named Scott Spoolman who's going to be talking about Wisconsin's beautiful waterways, and so that will be interesting. And we also have an essayist Melissa Palavino, who is going to be talking about the craft of writing about ourselves and others, and she's written a collection of essays called Tomboyland that have been very well received and are about Wisconsin. But we have lots of fiction, lots of nonfiction. We've got poetry events. And so really we try to find something of interest to everybody in all ages. We also have a children's writer that's going to be doing an event and have things for kids as well.
Is that the pizza and taco book?
It is. It is.
I love that title. Pizza and Taco, Dare to be Scared. Because it's that time of year. So great. Well, it sounds like fun. Are any of those books that you've read before, Jonathan? I mean, do you have time to read other authors?
I have not read any of those books.
Okay.
But I do read. One perk of writing a book that attracted attention is a lot of people want me to read their books to then, you know, put the little words on the back of
a book. Sure.
I've read some really, really interesting books.
Mm-hmm. That's always a good way to find a good one. When you find an author who recommends one, you'll probably like it too. So let's get back to our fish owls here. And I want to just let people know, if you're interested and if you haven't already Googled fish owl, you can go to Jonathan's site. So it's, let's see, what is it? Jonathan Slatt, and it's SLAGHT.com. And you've got a lot of really cool pictures and whatnot. And if you've Googled it, you probably actually saw John holding up a fish owl because when I did, there you were, one of the first ones that came up. So what was that feeling like when you first captured one and had it in your arms?
Oh, it was incredible. I mean, I don't remember what page it takes for me to get a fish owl, something like 200. So like, it seems like you're halfway through the book before we finally get one. And, you know, there were a few things, right? So for this was, you know, I needed this data for the PhD. So there was that. So mm-hmm. if we couldn't actually catch one, there were, you know, academic ramifications. But then at the same time, you know, we really wanted to, we were doing this work, my Russian colleagues and I, because we wanted to help the species. And so finally, after, you know, we were sleeping in a tent for weeks. Sometimes it was minus 30, and it's not fun to be in a tent at minus 30.
No.
And you eventually caught one, and we ended up getting four in a week. So once we sort of figured out the methodology that you know cracked the case, and we're able to move forward quickly after that. But it was quite a long, pretty depressing period.
And you were able to capture that really, really well in the book. Did you take, you have a journal? Is that how you remembered all these events?
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, part of it was, you know, because I'm very much immersed in everything Russian when I'm over there, you know, because I'm not in a city where there's access to other media that might be more familiar. I'm in a Russian truck next to a Russian river, living with, you know, 3 to 5 Russian dudes in this truck, where everything is just, you know, very condensed, very tight. And so I started writing for a few reasons. One of them was to, you know, be able to express myself in English, because I'm a fluent Russian speaker, but I don't, you know, I'm not articulate in a way that I can be in my native language.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I wanted to write down some of the strange things that were happening, because we'd be, you know, for example, you know, going across a river, and we'd almost get kind of sucked away, and we'd come out the other side, and I'd look at people like, holy smokes, like, what just happened? And they're like, it's normal for them. Again, these people living on the fringes,
Right. Weird,
you know, strange and dangerous, and what we would consider adventurous things happen all the time. But for them, it was routine for them. And so I wanted to sort of remember some of these things and write those down.
Well, I'm glad you did, because that really, I mean, it's all of the seasoning for your research, which, of course, mm-hmm. is the main meal. Mm-hmm. How are things going now with the fish owl?
Things are, generally speaking, okay. I mean, I haven't been back since October of 2019, just before the pandemic.
Okay.
So there are two Sergeys in the book. There's Sergey Avdiyuk, who's the guy it's the two of us are always together.
Uh-huh.
And then there's Sergey Surmich, who's sort of this ornithologist who's overseeing kind of the Russian side as far as logistics and planning goes. Both of them are still involved with Fishels. We still do work every year to some degree or another with Fishels. You know, now that I'm not a graduate student studying Fishels, and I oversee our work in China, Mongolia, Central Asia, Afghanistan, and then our projects in Russia, I have a huge mandate now. So it's not as much as I'd like to do. It's still kind of the favorite part of my job, but we do something. And the owls, I guess, are doing okay. Most of their range in Russia, there's still no roads. Fishing is still somewhat limited due to access. It's really just in the southern part of their range where we work that there's this really big threat. And I think we're doing a decent job of putting guardrails in place to protect them.
Mm-hmm. Now, why would the fish owls be, like, man being a problem, obviously? Why were they hunted? Are they used for anything particular?
Well, I mean, they're not really hunted.
Okay.
About 100 years ago, indigenous Udege would, in autumn especially, they would trap them because these birds, they're not migratory, they're long, cold winters. They put on these really thick fat reserves.
But
just like a bear might, right? And so they would catch them then for these to eat these big fatty birds. But that's not really done anymore. And today it's really, a Russian hunter will see something, this giant thing in the tree, and be like, what in the Lord is that? And they'll take a shot. Sometimes, and this is true, that people have killed fish owls just to see what it is. And it's like, oh, it's a big owl, and then move on. The problem is more putting in roads, which leads to logging, which leads to illegal salmon poaching. So people will put nets across an entire waterway. And if you're blocking the salmon from getting upstream, they're not reaching the fish owl's territory.
Sure.
Sometimes owls will be attracted to those nets because they hear the fish flopping about and will drown in the nets.
Mm-hmm.
And then roads, if it's a good enough road, if it's flat enough and cars can go fast enough, owls are also being hit and killed by cars.
Oh, sure. And that happens here, too. For some reason, owls like to fly into cars. I'm not sure why. Maybe we'll ask our next guest about that one. Now, I was interested, you're out there. It's always pretty much always the winter into spring because why?
Yeah, so the trapping season was unfortunately the worst time for humans to be in the forest because, we trap them by bringing using fish as lures, so fish in the rivers. And, outside of winter, a fish owl territory is there's just, kilometers and kilometers and kilometers of river. How are you going to attract an owl to one spot? In winter, there are a few spots, 2, 3, 5 in a fish owl's territory where the water's unfrozen for one reason or another. And there's only a few places where they can actually get food. And so that's where we target our captures.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it's the most efficient and reliable time of year to catch them.
Yeah, too bad for you. It wasn't in the middle of summer, but then you'd have to deal with mosquitoes, right? Or some kind of bugs.
Different set of problems, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And the other thing, too, is with the trees. Now, they need really big old trees for nesting, right?
Right. Yeah, and so it's an interesting, people, when I start talking about fish owls and the reliance on these big old trees and they start talking about logging, people make these mental connections to the Pacific Northwest where you've got a spotted owl nesting in a tree that has a commercial value of, six-figure commercial value. There's no commercial value to the trees that the fish owls are nesting in. They're these big, rotten cottonwoods. So, I live in Minneapolis. I go down to the Mississippi River floodplain. I see these big cottonwoods. I think that's a good fish owl nest tree. So the issue is more when the roads are being built. Sometimes some of these big trees are just cut because they're in the way. Sometimes they're cut. And used as temporary makeshift bridges. And the problem is it takes 200-300 years for a tree to become large enough to fit a fish owl.
Mm-hmm.
And so if these big trees are being cut down and they're not replaced, then the fish owls, they'll sit there on a territory and not breed if they don't have a suitable spot to nest in.
I like your description of the one that was in a nest that was a little bit too small for her and kind of sticking out.
Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous. It's almost like a house pet trying to hide under the couch with just its head.
Yeah. Or a big dog in a kitty cat's bed, right?
Sure. Right.
Exactly. So one of the things that I've always wondered about when you're out in the field doing this research, it's kind of like the prime directive in Star Trek. How do you know when you should be intervening and how do you know when you should just stay back? So for instance, didn't have anything to do with the fish owl, but the deer that fell into the river. And then there was that poor little kitty that you had to leave. Now, how did you decide if you should help or you shouldn't?
First of all, let me say, I don't get hate mail, but the angriest mail I get has to do with that cat. So I'm not going to talk about it.
I shouldn't have said anything. I can understand why. Okay. So we'll read the book and you'll find out, and then you can send your hate mail directly. I'm sorry, Jonathan.
So what happened with the deer was this was a deer that ran, it flushed from me. It ran away from me and then fell into the water, fell through the ice or into an open water section and was going to drown. And I felt that I should at least try to help it out.
That was amazing. I mean, the description, I could see it all in front of me. Your description was so good on that. But yeah, it's got to be hard because it's nature. Nature's not easy.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a little on the stern side around my house. I have young kids, and you know, they see injured animals, and they want to intervene and protect. And
of course.
My attitude is, in many cases, let nature take its course.
Right. Okay, well, and then so right now you're focusing, tell us a little bit about the job that you're doing right now. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so I mentioned that I oversee this large area. So with the Wildlife Conservation Society is where we're based in New York City. We're more than 100 years old. Half of what we do is New York City zoos, so you know, Bronx Zoo, Central Park Zoo, that's WCS. But then the other half is the part that I'm on, which is international conservation. So we're in 60 countries. We have hundreds of conservation projects throughout the world. And I oversee our work in, as I said, China, Mongolia, Afghanistan, and projects in Central Asia and Russia. So a lot of big cat issues, tigers, snow leopards. I still do birds, at least migratory birds that sort of breed in Alaska and northern Siberia, then migrate down through China to Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. So those are types of projects that I'm involved in.
And where can people find more information about what you're doing?
Well, I mean, my organization's website is wcs.org, and mm-hmm. that talks about all the work we do throughout the world.
Okay.
That's probably the best spot.
Perfect. Excellent. Well, maybe we can have you back and you can give us a little bit more information about what you're doing in other areas besides our friend the fish owl. So
yeah,
thank you for being with us. And then, Pam, let's go to you now for the rest of the few minutes we have left here. And tell us again about what we can expect if we go to the book festival and how we can connect with you.
Well, our website is cvbookfest.org. And you can find out about all the authors and all the events and register for things that look good to you. But one of the things that you can expect is to add books to your to-be-read pile. Because some people think that they have to read the books ahead of time, and that's absolutely not true. Book festivals are one of the best places to find new books to read. And so there's nothing better than having the author tell you about their book to get you going and want to read it. It's also a great place for writers because many of the authors are going to talk about the craft of writing. And so if you're a writer and want tips on writing or publishing, it's wonderful to be able to ask questions directly of the authors and find out information like that.
John, we'll go back to you real quick. How do you do? I'm sure you've done a number of these. What do you get out of like these book festivals and public appearances?
I like sharing a part of the world that few people have heard of. And I think people who have, my presentation is about 40 minutes. It's very, very visual.
Sure.
And it's a lot of photos from events that happen in the book. So I think people who have read the book get a lot out of it because they're like, oh, that's what, you know, Andrei Kutkov looks like, or, oh, that's what that's where that cabin is. And I just, that's what I like. I like making people care about something that's happening in a part of the world that they'll probably never go to.
No. Do you plan on making or writing another book at some point?
Yeah, I'm under contract now. It's a book about tigers in Russia. That's due to my publisher in a few months. So I'm wrapping it up.
Yeah, we'll look forward to hearing about that. And thank you for your work that you're doing in the conservation field. It's much appreciated. Pam, one more time, the website and how people can actually attend or how they can do it virtually.
Sure. The website is cvbookfest.org, and there will be a place to register. You can read up on the events and decide which ones you might be most interested in attending, and you just click the registration button, and you'll get a confirmation of your registration afterwards. But when you register, you'll be asked whether you want to register for in-person or for virtual. And if you go to the virtual route, a couple of the events are sold out. Well, not sold, are filled. And so you'll want to sign up for the virtual link so that you can watch it at home.
Okay. So even though it says sold out on it, you can still watch it, even though you can't attend in person.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So I want to make sure that people knew that. And we also, to let you know, we have both links to Jonathan's website and to the Chippewa Valley Book Festival on our program note. So if you just want to go to WPR.org/Larry, look for this program, and right underneath you'll see related links, and they will get you right there. Well, thank you both so much for being with us today. It was so interesting. And good luck with the event. So thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to mention that you can also buy the books at the festival and get them autographed by the author.
Oh, cool. Nice. Yes, that'll definitely be fun. So thank you both. Appreciate it. We've been talking to Jonathan Slatt, who's the author of the book Owls of the Eastern Ice, A Quest to Find and Save the World's Largest Owl, and Pam Gradow, Grado, organizer of the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. And you can hear John speak on Friday, whether in person or virtual. And stay with us, because we'll be talking about the Midwestern owls that you probably know right after this.